The Prosecutor's Podcast is brought to you by Progressive. Progressive helps you compare direct auto rates from a variety of companies so you can find a great one, even if it's not with them. Quote today at Progressive.com to find a rate that works with your budget. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations.
Hello, everyone. This is Mike.
And this is Gibby.
And we're the hosts of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. If you haven't already, we'd love to invite you to come check us out. Starting in January of 2017, we've amassed over 230 episodes of some of the most intriguing unsolved cases in true crime history. We cover some of the very big unsolved cases, but we also like to cover some of the lesser known cases, some that you may have never heard of. We dive into the details. We talk about the victims, their life, the circumstances around their disappearance or murder, and we cover the potential suspects and persons of interest. We try to give you all the known facts you need to satisfy your amateur detective. We like to think that we don't take ourselves all that seriously, but we take true crime very seriously. You can listen to True Crime All the Time Unsolved now on Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know you want to. I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Prosecutors. Today on the Prosecutors, we take another look at the Alan Greenberg case through the lens of your questions and comments. And welcome to this episode of The Prosecutors. I'm Brett, and I'm joined, as always, by my true blue co-host, Alice.
Oh, hey, Brett. That sounds so, like, down home and homey. I love it.
Down home and homey.
And homey. When I was in Wyoming, there were, like, you know, all these horses you could ride, and there was one named Blue, and I called him True Blue. So that made me...
Think of
True Blue.
Well, there you go. You and your horse.
Me and my horse.
You're a horsewoman, right? Isn't that another one of your exploits?
I was an equestrian at one time.
There you go.
Yes,
of course
I was
are.
An equestrian. I was a collegiate equestrian, but no longer. I mean, like, you know.
You know, somebody suggested we do bingo for this show, which I thought was a great thing. I'm going to put together bingo cards. So shout out to that person who did that. And, you know, you would think we'd run out, but Alice mentions new hobby that no one knew about should definitely be one of the things. And the thing is, I call it a hobby, but equestrian in college is one of those things that should take up all of your time. And yet you manage to find time for all this other stuff. It's just like, are you really a vampire? Have you lived like 150 years and you're just...
Or I'm the world's greatest con woman, and all of these are just lies. You don't know.
That's true. How would I know? A new mystery to explore.
Have you seen me on a horse?
I haven't, but I've heard of True Blue, but maybe that was a lie. That was a lie, Blue. No True Blue for you.
All I'm saying is, Brett, we're putting your lie detector to the test.
Well, you fooled me completely. I just assumed everything you were saying was true, but maybe it wasn't.
Well, I have said this before, though. Like, 98% of everything I've done in my life that's cool happened well before children and in my 20s.
Yeah.
So like, I am now just boring.
It's amazing how much you could accomplish back in the... Back in the child-free days.
Because you actually had the hours in a day. Like today, I had 1 hour of free time to myself. And when I say free time, I mean, I spent it with you. But, you know, it was awesome. I'm really glad we recorded. But it was like my kids were asleep. I had like my headphones on, but I had it kind of cocked to the side so I could hear from my screaming child. You know, like that's like stressful.
I noticed that when we were doing that.
I knew you knew what I was doing. I was like, because I don't know if you could hear, but my child was definitely like whispering to me and I was ignoring him aggressively.
You did a great job.
Thank you. I ignored him like insane. I started speaking louder, and he went back upstairs.
There you go. Parenting tips for everybody out there. That's the way you handle your kids. Just ignore them.
Noise-canceling headphones, and sometimes you pull them apart so you can see if someone's actually screaming at the top of their lungs.
I think we're going to have extra banter today because this is like a bonus episode. And we told y'all we weren't even going to do an episode. We're just so obsessed with doing a podcast that, like, even when we're like, we're going to take this week off, it's like, never mind. We're not going to take the week off.
No breaks for us ever.
Yeah. I know I promised you guys a Get Vocal thing, which those of you don't know, if you're a patron, every now and then, it's supposed to be every month, but we don't quite make it every month, we do a Get Vocal and you can get on and talk to us and we're on camera. Everybody's on camera. You don't have to be on camera if you don't want to. And ask us whatever you want to ask. And we record it, and then eventually we release it publicly. So we're going to do that tomorrow. So you guys will get two episodes. You actually get three if you listen to Legal Breeze. So much for a week off. But
overachievers. But
the problem was that you guys out there, you just had so many great questions, comments about Ellen Greenberg that I just felt like we can't just leave it. We have to address some of these amazing things that you guys came up with. I mean, I just got to tell you, we did JonBenet Ramsey, and it was super controversial, and there were all sorts of conspiracy theories about how I'm really, you know, John Ramsey's brother-in-law or something, and and we work for the lawyer guy from Georgia, Lynn Wood, and it was just all one big conspiracy. You know, we had all that craziness, and then obviously a lot of people were really into our Casey Anthony stuff, but I have never seen anything like the response that Ellen Greenberg got. I mean, you guys sent tons of emails. The gallery on Facebook was just exploding.
Our social media was popping.
It was amazing. I've never seen anything like it. I couldn't keep up with it. It was just wild. And from all that, I was like, shoot, these are some really great points. So we got to do some more talking. And it's such an interesting case that there's no shortage of things to discuss. So that's so why true. We're here.
Yes. So thank you guys for giving us fodder for today's episode. And they're all really great points, like Brett said. And I think, you know, I was personally surprised how split people were in whether they thought this was a suicide or murder, to be totally honest. And I think that's because it's so hard to know what we know in this case, because it comes down to one potential witness and then a lot of kind of just bad investigation at the start. And you just don't know what you don't know. But one of the very interesting things is people have said online, it's said that Sam sent Ellen emails. Well, did he or did he not? Because we had not covered that in our timeline. Now, we know that Sam sent at least one between the text he sent at 5:54:39, which was, you better have an excuse, and the one he sent at 5:57:41, what the F, he sent an email. So 3 minutes between those texts, and then he also sent an email. And the email had the subject with capital O open, and the body of the email said, the effing door. That was sent at 5:55. So in other words, text at 5:54, email at 5:55 with basically the same message, and then 5:57, another text. So it's fair to say, I think he's trying to reach her however he can, just in case she didn't have her phone on her. He's sending her an email in case she's by her computer.
Yeah, and, you know, it's just, there's so much energy behind this case, and people are so interested in it that there are people who were really digging down into every little thing we mentioned. So we had mentioned that he sent some emails, but people thought, since we didn't read them, maybe that was a lie, and, well, the police should be able to know if he sent emails. If he said he sent emails and he didn't, that means he did it or whatever. And it's like, whoa, 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 we just didn't have the emails. So there's at least this one email that is available if you dig into some of the stuff that's been released. There may have been other emails, but this one is very consistent with the overall tenor of everything. And this was another thing people commented on a lot. Is this unusual, the way that he was talking to her? I will say that Gavin Fish, who we mentioned a lot, who's just great. I mean, I love that guy. He's amazing. Really amazing in this case. Just, it's a blessing to find him through this case. He has access to a large number of communications. I mean, we're talking about years worth of text messages. He's got pretty much everything. And he has looked through this and says that essentially the way that Sam was speaking to her that night was actually not reflected in the rest of his text. For instance, he almost never used the F word in text to her. And obviously in the emails and the text, he's using that. So what does that mean? Well, I think one thing it says is to the extent this was a controlling, abusive relationship, and we don't know that it was, but to the extent it was, it's not reflected in the way he talked to her. And I think that's interesting because, frankly, I don't know that someone who is abusive can avoid talking to someone like that throughout the course of their relationship. For instance, if you think he's abusive and you think these texts reflect that, that's because you think this is the way someone would text someone, that they're being abusive, that they're using coercive control. All that sort of stuff is reflected in these texts. But the fact that there isn't a lot of communication like this before tells me that maybe this is just he's angry because he's been locked outside, which is a very ordinary reaction. And I think a lot of people said, and I think it's true, that the average person, if they get locked out, and for whatever reason, they're not concerned, they're not worried about the person, they think this is some sort of angry act by the other person, this is how they would react. They would be annoyed. They would be irritated. They might, you know, drop some F-bombs. And a lot of people said, hey, my husband, my wife loves me very much, but if I did this, they would do the same thing. And I think if it weren't for everything else going on in this case, yes, there are some texts that are concerning, but I don't think the fact that he's angry itself is either that surprising or really even tells us that much.
But I do think the interspersion of the texts and the emails lends more credence to the fact that he's really surprised that this is not staged to make it appear he doesn't know the door's locked. By trying to reach her in multiple modes seems to suggest that he's very surprised and actually emotional about the fact that the door is locked and that she's doing this intentionally. There's no need to stage it in multiple ways if you can just send a bunch of text messages, but like the text and the email seems to be, let's say they had a big fight, and I don't know this for a fact, I'm just speculating. Let's say he knows she turns off her phone when she's really mad at him and wants to ignore his texts. Maybe he's trying to go the email route because he knows that she has her computer with her and wants to make sure she sees this message. But by going multiple modes of communication, it doesn't really lend credence necessarily to your alibi, if it is an alibi. So if anything, I would just say that the multiple ways of communicating with her to me suggests that this is really heat of the moment. He is reacting to the situation he is finding, which is that there's a locked door.
And one of the things we talked about in the very last episode is my thing that I'm convinced of. I am convinced that they had a massive fight that night. And I'm convinced of that no matter what happened. Whether she was murdered. The only way that I'm not convinced of that is if the only murders in the building scenario happened and he walks out and there's somebody watching, and as soon as he leaves, they're knocking on the door and going in and having a fight with her and murdering her and then slipping out and no one ever sees them. The problem with that is they would have needed to be pretty lucky or pretty good, because the police have analyzed the cameras in the lobby. They haven't seen any unusual people that they can't account for. So if this were a random murder, the person got away without being on camera. But put that aside, assuming that didn't happen, I think there was a huge fight that night. I think there was a huge fight. I don't know what it was over. It doesn't really matter what it was over. I think it's even possible they broke off their relationship, that this was going to be the end of their relationship. They weren't going to get married anymore. And that was the state of mind. And he goes down to the gym because that's the kind of thing you do when you're really, really mad. A lot of people, when they're really mad or they're really upset, going for a run, lifting weights, doing something like that is a great way to sort of blow off steam, to calm down, to get out some of that angry energy and maybe come back with a little bit cooler head. So in my mind, I think they probably had a huge fight. He leaves, he goes to the gym. This is assuming he didn't murder her. He goes to the gym, he comes back, and when the door's locked, his first thought is, she's doing this just because we got in this huge fight. Now she's locked me out like a child, you know? Like, that's what she's done. And that's why he was so angry, because he thought, and that's why he wasn't worried about her, because he thought, this is just a childish, stupid thing she's doing to make me mad and make my life more difficult. She's locked me out. Now I can't get in. I mean, And so he's firing off these text messages. He's very angry, almost out of character, maybe, text messages. And that's sort of what's going on. And I think that's a very viable option. I mean, if it's suicide, that's what I think happened.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Brett. Now, another great point you guys made. Remember we said that one of the strange things that the doorman noted about Sam was that he was wearing Timberland boots. And several of you posted surveillance footage of Sam walking out of the gym, and it looked like he had sneakers on or something that wasn't Timberland boots. So the question is, was Sam wearing Timberland boots or not? And the argument here is, would it be strange for someone to wear Timberland boots to go to the gym? You know, is that something that you would do? And if it is, then does it suggest he wasn't really going to the gym? Now, there are three possibilities as to what happened here. First, the doorman's statement was either incorrect or it never happened and has just been misreported. And that can happen. So, you know, maybe he didn't say that, or he did say it, but he was mistaken, or the police just misreported it somehow.
And let me say about that first option. One thing about this statement, it's everywhere. Everybody who's covered it mentions this statement. I feel pretty confident it did happen, but you won't find it anywhere. So it's not in the police report. It's not in any of the documents that we have publicly. My understanding is it is in some documents. They're not public. But we haven't seen those, and so you can't be 100% certain about this, even though everybody said it. People say things all the times on podcasts that turn out not to be true. It could just be that the first podcast said it and everybody else ran with it. I wish we had the confirmation. But like I said, I'll say I am more confident that this did happen, that he did say this, the doorman did say this, than that I think this is just somehow made up. I think the doorman said it. It may just not have been exactly what we thought it was.
And that happens. This is why we tell you guys that direct evidence, which is someone saying they saw something, is not always that reliable. People's memories, you know, are shaded when you don't know something that you're seeing is going to be important later on. Now, another possibility is when the police took Sam into custody to give a statement at the police station, they let him change into Timberland boots so he could walk more comfortably outside in the snow. Remember, this was the day that the nor'easter was coming through. There was a lot of snow, a lot of wind. It was tough winter weather. So it's possible that after Sam changed into the Timberland boots at the kind of direction of the police, the doorman noticed the boots at this point as they were leaving the building and mistakenly believed it was significant. So again, the doorman may have just gotten his timing wrong as to when he saw Sam in the Timberland boots. Or it's a similar story with the doorman, but it was Sam who changed his shoes after he got into the building. So all to say is we know we have surveillance video of Sam in kind of these white tennis shoes as he's going up to the apartment door to break it down. And we know that there's at least reporting that the doorman saw Sam in Timberland boots. But the timing of all these may just be kind of muddled. And again, this just happens sometimes. This is why it's important to put people on the stand and ask them questions, because sometimes the truth is somewhere in between. And when you ask targeted questions, people's minds sharpen, or you begin to see kind of where the truth is, even if their memory is hazy.
And let me just say, this is a weakness of doing this whole podcasting thing. All I can rely on is what's publicly reported. The police know whether or not the doorman said this. If the doorman said this to the police know it. And the police, having known what the doorman said, would also know whether or not they let Sam change shoes. Sam changing shoes is it makes tons of sense. He's being taken into custody, but it's not as if he's technically a murder suspect because you have a dead body and you don't yet know what the cause of death is. But it's not as if the police really thought he killed anybody. It's not as if he's some sort of dangerous criminal. They're going to let him change shoes. They're not going to make him walk out of there in his tennis shoes, in the shoes he wears to the gym, if he doesn't want to. So if somebody thought of that, I totally see him saying, one of the officers saying, hey, do you want to change shoes? It's nasty out there. You can imagine something like that. They come down. The doorman notices sort of the commotion of the police leaving with Sam, and that's when he really notices what Sam's wearing. Because remember, when Sam's initially talking to the doorman about breaking down the door, he probably thinks that's weird, but it's nowhere near as elevated a consciousness as someone has been murdered in the building. When that happened, suddenly for the doorman, this day that was just boring and might have been punctuated by some crazy guy who wants to break his own door down becomes a day he'll never forget. So you could imagine he hears that and he sees Sam coming down. So of course he's going to want to watch them leave. And when he does, he notices he's wearing these boots and he thinks to himself, man, that's weird. He told me he was at the gym and he's wearing boots. And then we end up where we are. If, however, he did tell the police this about the boots, and the police didn't let Sam change his shoes, say Sam was wearing the boots when the police showed up, that would be pretty significant, because that means sometime between when Sam leaves the doorman, because we have video of Sam leaving the doorman to go upstairs to break down his door. When he leaves him then, he is wearing the white tennis shoes. If he put on the boots, it would have been after he got into his apartment, but before he called the police. And that would be strange, because why is he changing his shoes? That would be something that was kind of significant. So this is important. It's important if this guy actually made this statement, and it's important what the context is. But we unfortunately just don't know the answer to those questions. So for now, that will have to remain speculation.
It is frustrating when we don't know all the facts, but there you have it. So thanks for bringing that up, though, because I do think this is an important fact. We just don't know enough to kind of put a pin in it.
So let's talk about the engagement ring. We had a lot of comments about this, and most of them said that it's not unusual that they take off, the ladies out there take off their engagement rings all the time. I'll say this was surprising to me, because I know a lot of people who are married or who are engaged, and a lot of them have told me that they never take off their engagement rings / wedding rings unless it's for some purpose. For instance, a lot of people talked about how they were nurses. Well, of course, nurses take their jewelry off. I mean, that's a pretty common thing if you're a nurse. But sort of outside of that, or outside of you're going to do something that might damage it or you might lose it, most of the people I talked to just in my life were like, oh, I never take it off. The other thing I wonder about this, most of the people who sort of got back to this for us are married people who've been married for a while. And I remember right after I was married that I very rarely took off my wedding ring. And then this became a problem because my wedding ring is not sized great, so it would just fall off. Or I'd be asleep and I'd wake up, my wedding ring would be somewhere in the bed, that kind of thing. So I did start taking it off. But immediately after getting married, I didn't take it off because, you know, I didn't want to take off my wedding ring. And I feel like a lot of women, when they're newly engaged, probably don't take off their engagement ring, at least for a little while. So I don't know. I don't want to affix too much importance to this because we don't know. It would be nice if we knew somebody who knew Ellen, who could sort of give us some information on this, if even they knew. I would be interested to hear from a friend. If there was a friend who said, I knew her, and she would never take that ring off unless there was a reason, that would tell us a lot, because the ring being off could be consistent with this big fight, with a breakup, with a plan to leave, all that kind of stuff. Or it could just be she took her ring off because she's going to peel an orange. We just don't know.
Yeah, this one's so hard because it's just so person specific. I think it's totally normal to take your ring off and also totally normal not to take your ring off. And it's just based on what her normal practice is, unless this whole fight breakup thing did happen and she was someone who never took her ring off. And here you have her ring off. That could be significant. But we don't have much more to say here on this, except, you know, yeah, we agree with you. Either of those behaviors could be completely normal. It just depends on what her actions were typically. Now, another thing that you guys did bring up or ask questions about was whether Ellen had an eating disorder. And this was because some people noted that Ellen looks extremely thin in the last few photos of her. And some folks who have overcome eating disorders in the past noted that some of the photos were consistent with someone who was suffering from anorexia. We do know that Ellen was reaching out to her therapist a lot in the month before or the month of her death. We know she seemed to be really suffering with anxiety, with something. She was seeking, you know, some medication to help her feel normal again. And those are all potential side effects slash go hand in hand with eating disorders that's possible. But I don't know that we have any direct knowledge that she was having an eating disorder. I think it's tough to look at a picture, honestly, to know if someone does have an eating disorder. I know there are things you can look at, like the way your stomach can be bloated or the way certain parts of your body can be sunken if you are suffering from an eating disorder. But also remember, like, drugs, medications can have effects on your body and how it's metabolizing. Illnesses, undiagnosed or diagnosed, can have effects on how you look that you may not know. Anxiety has a massive effect on how you look physically as well. And we know for a fact that she was certainly suffering from a lot of anxiety around this time. So I don't know, unless Brett, you know of some other knowledge that she had an eating disorder. We haven't seen that. No, I don't think anyone has said in evidence that she was suffering from an eating disorder.
So I don't have any evidence of it. I will say I'm eternally impressed by everyone out there and their willingness to write in and share their own life struggles and victories with us and with other people, and sort of helping people understand things that they've never experienced. This was not even something I thought about with Ellen, but people who've struggled with this basically were like, look, if you look at, you know, her shoulder and her arms, that's exactly what mine looked like when I was anorexic, because basically there's almost no definition between those two places, and that's the kind of thing that happens when you're not eating. I have no idea if she was or not. One of the things that people brought up who have struggled with that is that anorexia can lead to depression. It can lead to all sorts of violent mood swings. It can be something that has a huge effect, obviously, on your self-esteem and how you view yourself. And it opens you up to, you know, sharp reactions to minor criticisms even. So, you know, if he made some mean comment about her, for instance, that might be the kind of thing that if she were struggling with that would be problematic. I don't know the answer to it. I haven't seen any reporting that she was. It was something people brought up, so we wanted to address it. I can't say for certain. She didn't discuss it with her therapist, or if she did, it hasn't come out publicly. I'm sure that's the kind of thing that the police in this reinvestigation will look into. Hopefully this reinvestigation will be the kind of fulsome look into Ellen's life, into Sam's life, and into their relationship that will answer so many of these questions, because the questions you guys are asking are all pertinent, relevant questions that really get to whether or not this was a suicide or a murder. One of the reasons we're here struggling with this mystery is because we don't have all the pieces. That's the thing about mysteries. Once you have all the pieces, there's no mystery. So you really only have mysteries when there are pieces that are missing. And because of the shoddy police work in the beginning, there are a lot of missing pieces in this case. So hopefully these are the kind of things that people look into. I wanted to note, some people asked, why is everybody focusing on Ellen and her mental state? If she was murdered, what difference does it make? And it doesn't make any difference if she were murdered. If she's not, though, or if we're trying to figure out whether she was murdered, whether or not she was in a mental state that would have contributed to suicidal tendencies is important. One thing people have said again and again, and we try to disabuse everyone of this notion, it is not impossible to inflict the wounds that were inflicted on her, with one caveat that we're going to discuss in a bit. But assuming that she is capable physically of inflicting those wounds, as in she can still hold a knife, while it's difficult and it's awkward and it's weird and it's strange, you can do it. So if she's in an altered mental state, that is something that would be important. And it is something we have to face. It is something we have to address. And we can't shy away from it, because Sam deserves some consideration here too. We can't ignore evidence that Ellen may or may not have had suicidal tendencies when Sam's life hangs in the balance too. And if he's innocent of this, he deserves to be cleared and he deserves to be able to go on with his life. So we have to talk about this stuff. I know it's difficult at times. One thing I wanted to mention in relation to the stab wounds. One thing people did, and I totally get doing this, is we got a lot of really weird stabbing deaths. And people would send us other situations in which people stab themselves multiple times. And that was their method of suicide. A couple things about that. Number one, no one is saying that this never happens or it's impossible. We're not saying that. It is incredibly rare. And that is true even if you can find some examples of people doing this to themselves. And when you look at those, always note the differences. So for instance, one of the ones people sent us, number one, it was a male. Men are much more likely to stab themselves than women are. Number two, they left a note. We don't have a note in this case. Number three, the knife wasn't found in the body. It was found beside the body, which is consistent with suicide. As some of the experts have said, suicides typically don't leave the knife in the body. They remove it, which happened in that case. So it's not just the stab wounds that make this unique. It's everything combined together. And just because something like this has happened somewhere doesn't mean that this would not be an incredibly unusual way to kill yourself. Another thing, I just want to go over again, the position of the body. We get a lot of questions about this. So in the 911 call, there's a couple things that are significant about it. The first is he doesn't see the knife. I mean, that's the most significant thing, right? The fact that he doesn't see the knife. And so some people have been playing with the positioning of the body. Is it possible that she was sort of seated with her back against the cabinets, slumped forward, with her head sort of slumped forward, her hair, she had long hair, sort of coming down, draping over her, and all of this could have draped over the knife and concealed it? And that is a way to sort of make sense of the fact that he doesn't see the knife. So he doesn't want to move the body, he doesn't want to touch the body, and it's sort of in this position where, because of all that, you can't see the knife. So that's something people asked. Two things about that. Number one, it is hard not to go back to this 911 call. The fact that Sam says she's flat on her back. And I listened to it again, the 911 call, because I thought maybe we misheard it or he didn't say that. But he actually says that she's flat on her back and begins to ask, he says, should I something, right? And you almost feel like he's saying, should I prop her up or something like that? Because she's flat on her back. Obviously, the 911 operator moves on from that. So if you believe what he's saying, she would be flat on her back, which is not consistent with her sitting up against the cabinets.
But would be consistent with that line of blood that we found coagulated that indicated she was leaning to one side at some point. So, Brett, as you know, we love to talk about our kids because we love our kids. And what is most important for us in raising our kids is making sure they get good opportunities, hands-on to learn. That's why we are so excited about our newest sponsor, KiwiCo. KiwiCo helps kids learn at a young age what will stick with them through adulthood. And that's why fostering a lifelong love of learning for our children is so important. And KiwiCo makes learning fun. KiwiCo is defining the future of play by making it engaging, enriching, and seriously entertaining. They offer these subscriptions that deliver super cool hands-on projects for kids and kids at heart of all ages. And they really have something for all your kids. My two-year-old got this amazing set that helps him with his fine motor skills in going fishing with magnets. It helps him think and also is age-appropriate. My four-year-old is a little bit more advanced and has this amazing science kit where he learns about the interactions of very basic chemicals. And it's amazing to see them dive in, love what they're doing, and learn.
Yeah, Alice, my daughter loves animals and she got a armadillo bowling kit, which might not sound like learning, but it 100% was. She didn't know what an armadillo was. Now she loves armadillos, and her favorite thing about the kit was the little booklet that talked about armadillos and where they live and who their friends are. So there is something for everyone. You can cultivate your child's natural creativity and curiosity with new projects every month. And you'll be doing your part to encourage your children to be innovative and creative thinkers. They won't believe what they can build and accomplish with KiwiCo. So spark the love of learning today with a KiwiCo subscription. And this is an incredible deal. You will get 50% off your first month plus free shipping on any crate line with code PROSECUTORS at KiwiCo.com. That's right. 50% off your first month at KiwiCo.com, promo code PROSECUTORS. Your kids will love it.
The Prosecutor's Podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Let's face it, sometimes multitasking can be overwhelming. Like when your favorite podcast is playing and the person next to you is talking and your car fan is blasting, all while you're trying to find the perfect parking spot. But then again, sometimes multitasking is easy, like quoting with Progressive Insurance. They do the hard work of comparing rates so you can find a great rate that works for you, even if it's not with them. Give their nifty comparison tool a try, and you might just find getting the rate and coverage you deserve is easy.
All you need to do is visit Progressive's website to get a quote with all the coverages you want, like comprehensive and collision coverage or personal injury protection. Then you'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies all lined up and ready to compare, so it's simple to choose the rate and coverages you like. Press play on comparing auto rates. Quote at Progressive.com to join the over 27 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Right. And look, this is really hard to figure out. If Sam is innocent, this is really hard to figure out, because if she's flat on her back, then the knife is literally just sticking up in the air. And it is hard to figure out how he would not have seen the knife in that circumstance. Remember, the knife, it stabbed into her, so there's only the handle. So you might be thinking, well, maybe the handle's not that long. So the blade of this knife is about 12 to 13 centimeters. That's about how long the blade is. The handle itself is about the same length, if maybe not a little bit longer. So this is, I mean, it's a standard steak knife, but the handle is pretty significant. The handle is not so short and it's not so deep in her body that it would be hard to see this. It would have been sticking out of her in a way that should have been visible.
Can I say a very dark a dark demonstration I did tonight just to see what that would be like? I took a steak knife. I measured it. It's almost exactly the same length as the one at issue here. And I laid on the ground and I put it next to me so that it touched the floor. In other words, it was all the way through me. And I'm probably bigger than Ellen, because she was pretty thin and looked like she worked out. I think we've established that I don't work out enough. But it was, I was just laid on the floor, and we know that the knife didn't go through her, but I was trying to see, like, if the knife went all the way to my backbone and it was touching the floor, how much of the knife you could see. And it was pretty significant, especially because we know the knife was on the outside of her clothes. It wasn't under her clothes, right? She had a zippered jacket. She had two pieces of clothing, I believe, on, and the handle was still sticking out. I tried to position my hair. I kind of just tried to see if I could bunch my clothes up around it, and it was significant. I could not hide the fact that there was this large, hard, straight object sticking straight up from me, and even positioned myself in different ways and tried to ask my husband if he could see the knife, which he felt very uncomfortable doing as I pretended to be stabbed on the floor. But all to say is it's a significant amount to be sticking out, and it's hard to miss, because if you are flat on your back, there's nowhere for that knife to go but straight up.
Yeah. And let's talk about how she was actually found, because I feel like in our description of her, we may have misled people into thinking that the way I described was a possibility, that she was sort of sitting up with her back against the cabinets, slumped over, covering up this knife. That is not it. She's not flat on her back, but she's not sitting up either. So you have to imagine sort of she's laying in the middle of this kitchen, which, by the way, the kitchen, so you have this door that he had to break down, right? So the kitchen, if you are coming into the apartment from the outside, the kitchen's off to your right. So when he opened up the door and it caught on the latch, you would be able to see into the left part of the apartment. So he would not have been able to see into the kitchen when he had the door open. So he's got the door open. He's calling into her. She's, if he's telling the truth, is laying dead in the kitchen off to the right, a few feet away from him, and he can't see her. So she is laying at an angle. So there, so the kitchen cabinets form an L. It's a very standard sort of kitchen. So if you came in through the door, so let's continue this visualization. If you open that door and you came in and you close the door behind you and you turn to the right, you would see into the kitchen. It is an L-shaped kitchen. You'd be looking right at the stove. The countertop with the sink would be on your left. It forms this L. you would see Ellen laying in the floor at an angle with her head sort of where the two sides of this kitchen counter meet. So the kitchen counter meet, there's a corner. Her head, she's laying not flat on her back, but most of her body is on the ground. Her shoulders are just up just a little bit against the cabinets and the stove. Her head is sort of in this corner, leaning to the side, resting against the cabinet, okay? So she's not in a position where she's slumped over where she would be covering up this knife. She's laying there for all the world to see with a steak knife protruding from her shirt. I mean, I realize that if you're Sam, this would be a stunning thing to see your fiance laying on the floor like this, but man, I don't know how you don't see that knife. I hate to harp on this, but I don't know how you don't see that knife.
Yeah, it's a tough one to explain away.
I just want to say this too, and I get that this is probably nitpicky, but he says over and over again in that 911 call that there's blood everywhere, and there's just really not, particularly with her body laying on top of the significant pool of blood. What you would have had is you had a couple drops of blood up on the counter, which we mentioned before. There would be a little bit of blood on the cabinet behind her head. And then her glasses, which I guess she was wearing when all this started, I don't know. Her glasses are on the ground next to her right hand, and there's blood on the ground next to her glasses. And then she has this white towel in her left hand. So that's what you would see. And I'm not saying in this circumstance, if you were truly shocked out of your mind, that maybe that would be blood everywhere to you. But this is, when you hear him say that, you're expecting a scene like in The Staircase. You're expecting blood just all over the place. That is not the case. The fact there are 20 stab wounds and this little blood is really surprising.
So someone made a really good point, I think, in the gallery, that it sounded like the way Sam spoke on the 911 call, he was describing a scene that he wasn't actually looking at. And there are reasons that could be the case. Maybe it was too upsetting to actually look at the scene. Maybe you saw it really quickly and had to turn away because it was much too upsetting. Or you knew what you were going to find and you didn't need to look directly at the scene and didn't want to face, you know, what was before you as you described it. And so maybe in your mind there was a lot more blood than there actually was, but that he wasn't actually looking at the scene. That may account for why he said she was flat on her back when she maybe wasn't. That, I thought that was an interesting note. I don't know if that's actually what happened, but the way he describes things in the call seems to be inconsistent with what we know to be the actual crime scene, and one of the major ones being the amount of blood.
Yeah. It is so interesting that you say that, just because everything about the 911 call sounds like someone who is not really close to the scene. As I said, it feels like he's standing there sort of observing, but he's not close. And I don't have a whole lot. I realize I've rambled about this for a while here. I don't have a whole lot more to add about this other than it is inexplicable. The things he says in the crime scene, from the position of her body, from the amount of blood, the fact that he doesn't see the knife, is just wholly inconsistent with the reality of the situation. It's just wholly inconsistent. And I don't know how he can describe the scene the way he does. I really don't. It's just, it is a weird thing.
I think it fits better into the theory that I espoused in a previous episode, but but with that said,
I mean, maybe it does. I mean, maybe, I don't know. It's just, I tell you, I go back and forth on this case so much. I swing back and forth between what I think happened. And I can explain a lot of things. And we've sort of been doing that, right? And we've explained some things as we've gone on. Like, what could be the circumstance? Maybe it was this. Maybe it was that. Maybe this is what happened. It wasn't that big a deal. These things I can't explain. These things I can't sort of logic away. And a lot of you guys came up with the best logic away thing, which was her slumped over with her hair covering up the knife, black handle, black hair. Maybe you just can't see it. But no, I mean, it would have been sticking out like if it had had flashing lights on it, it wouldn't
like
have been
post.
Easier to see.
It was like
I mean,
post.
I just can't. Yeah, I just It's hard to believe.
The next point is about the reliability of experts. As we noted in our episodes, the experts of the family have leaned into the notion that Ellen did not kill herself. Some things we've heard from experts include that there were multiple injuries that did not bleed, the spinal cord was severed, the suicide searches were not actually on her computer, the wounds indicated the use of two different knives, and there was evidence of strangulation, and that Ellen was stabbed with her left hand even though she was right-handed. So if those things are true, it certainly seems to support the family's expert that there's no way Ellen could have killed herself. So what do we make of these? Here's the thing. I'm going to try to say this in the nicest way possible because I don't mean to disparage experts at all. But in any sort of a case, there are going to be many factors at play, many pieces of evidence. And we've talked about this before where a lot of evidence may have nothing to do with the actual crime at hand. But because we are looking at it post hoc, we are having to fit all the pieces together into a puzzle that we don't have a picture of, that we don't know if we have the right puzzle pieces. We don't know if there are puzzle pieces that should be left out. We don't know if there are puzzle pieces that are left in that shouldn't be there at all. And we have no picture that we know that we're working towards. What experts are trying to do is put these puzzle pieces together to tell some coherent story. So you can have experts looking, you can have two great experts who are very qualified looking at the same set of facts and come to diametrically opposed conclusions. Is it because they're lying? No, not necessarily. It could be that they are trying to make sense of the evidence they find most likely to fit together, that should fit together in the case before them. But because of this, each expert's opinion is that it is their opinion based on their expertise and their view of the world and their past experience in cases that they've looked at. Some things will jump out more to certain experts than others. This happens to us as prosecutors. Some things I find much more significant than other things because of past experience. Does it mean it dictates in the case at hand? Not necessarily. But all experts have to draw on these expertises and experiences to come up with the most likely conclusion. And because of that, and the widely differing experiences that all experts have, there is a reason why you will find experts on both sides of the V, for the prosecution or plaintiff and for the defense or defendant. And that's because there is a huge spectrum of the opinions that people can reach. And honestly, you would be hard pressed not to be able to find an expert on your side of the case at some point, because there are so many unknowns and so many factors to consider, and they can all be weaved into a different opinion. And that's why they are subjected to, you know, vigorous cross-examination and also battle of the experts to see what holds up best in terms of rationality and common sense.
And that last point Alice made was so important. So a lot of these articles are coming out right now in a lot of different newspapers. They are repeating these claims, which may or may not be true. I'm not saying they're not true. If these things are true, then there's no mystery left. She was murdered. And there's just no question. However, these claims are getting repeated and they're not tested. And in a trial, you would have other experts who've looked at the conclusions of these experts who could explain where maybe there are holes in their expertise or in their analysis, and you as a lawyer have the opportunity to question those experts and really test what they say. And this is the problem with expertise outside of that. You know, remember the whole Casey Anthony thing in R-Pod Vass. He sounded really convincing when he was talking about decomposition gases in the trunk before anybody questioned him. Once people started questioning him and he started having to defend his science, then things kind of fell apart. And we don't have that here yet. And that's why I caution people, just be careful assuming that just because an expert said these things, that they are true. A lot of these things are pretty dramatic. For instance, the notion that the first or second stab wound severed her spinal cord And therefore, from that point forward, she was not able to defend herself. That is one of the theories that we proposed. That's why there are no defensive wounds, because the first stab wound made it impossible for her to defend herself. That's an interesting hypothesis. But just because you can't work backwards from it, the fact that she had no defensive wounds doesn't mean that the first stab wound severed her spinal cord. I need to know why you're saying that. Recall, these experts are not looking at her body. They're looking at photographs. They're looking at reports. They are looking at primary sources, but not the body itself. And that's significant and really limits their ability to be sure about a lot of this stuff. I know that this medical examiner has not exactly bathed himself in glory, and there's been a lot of stuff that's come out about him and prior interpretations he's made of bodies that was clearly wrong, where he clearly got it wrong. And maybe this is one of those cases, but I would just caution people, when you see this stuff, don't assume it's gospel. This all needs to be tested. Hopefully, this new investigation will take this stuff seriously, but we'll either find it to be true or debunk it using other evidence or other experts. Experts are something we should probably talk about in a legal brief. There are some real problems with experts. Sort of the commodification of expert opinions has become a problem, where you have an expert opinion on both sides and they look at the same evidence and come to the opposite conclusion. And what does that mean about expertise in general? But one of the most important things is in a courtroom, in a case, you have that the crucible of cross-examination where a lot of this truth can be gotten to. You don't have that in the press. So we have a couple other things, but one other question people asked, which I think is a really interesting one, is would you cover up a murder like this? So if you think that this suicide was staged, then you have to ask yourself, would you stage it like this? And some people said, man, this is the weirdest suicide ever. Why would you even think to make it look like a suicide? You know, this is not your sort of typical, you forged a suicide note and, you know, you put the gun in their hand and made them shoot themselves. This is sort of a brutal attack with a knife, which then at some point you decide you're going to make it look a suicide. Would you really do that? I understand that question, but I think it's a little misguided, because put yourself in the shoes of someone if they did murder her. It was in a rage. It wasn't planned. This would have been a sudden thing. So imagine that this is a murder, and because let's put Sam out of it, because we don't want to, he's a real person. So imagine this is the only murders in the building scenario. Someone who's obsessed with her knocks on the door while Sam's at the gym, confesses his love for her. She rejects them. And in a rage, he stabs her to death. Now imagine he's standing there having just stabbed her to death. She's now laying in the floor and he's got to decide, what is he going to do? He has a couple options. He could just run. He could just run and hope they never connect it to him. That's one option. He could make it look like a break-in, so he could ransack the place, make it look like somebody tried to rob the place, and then flee. The problem he has there is, if he knows anything about the building, he'll know there's cameras in the lobby. And maybe he avoided those cameras, and maybe he intentionally did so, but he would have to think, if I make it look like a murder and the police can't find anybody who's coming in, they're going to think this wasn't actually a robbery gone wrong. This was somebody who killed her and then tried to make it look like a robbery. So maybe he decides not to do that. Well, all that really leaves is trying to make it look like a suicide. And he doesn't have to do much. All he does, really, is lock the door. All he has to do is trigger that sort of inside lock so that it looks like the door is locked from the inside. And that's his best bet if he's trying to make this look like a murder. Now, we've said in the last episode, it's also possible that he would just be trying to delay things as much as possible. He's not even trying to make it look like a suicide. He's just trying to delay it so he can get away, or so he can do whatever he needs to do to set it up. But assume he is trying to make it look like a suicide. Once he does that, then it's a locked room. There was no way in. Maybe he'll get lucky and the police will say it's a suicide, which would have been exactly what they did. So no, this is not how you would stage a suicide. But if you were desperate, desperate times call for desperate measures, and you really don't have any other choice other than run. And if you don't have the option to run, if you have to stick it out with this, then at least if you try and make it look like a suicide, you have a shot. Otherwise, you're basically dead to rights. So I think that's probably your best argument for why you would try and cover up this murder like it was a suicide.
And also the staging part, there's lots of different ways of staging. There's staging where you plan the whole thing before you even go in. But what Brett said was really important. This looks to be a killing of passion if it were a murder. Did not seem like it was planned out because of kind of the fruit on the table, the way the stabbing occurs. And she was caught by surprise if this were a murder, because, again, the fruit that she's washing, she's in the kitchen. And so the staging happens after the passion part. And you kind of are left with the ingredients at the scene, right? You have to work around what you have there. And this may be the best you can do if you are, in fact, trying to stage it.
So the last thing I want to mention, and then, Alice, if you have anything else, we can go through that as well. And just, I will say that, and this goes back to something I said earlier, I'm just really impressed by people and their willingness to open up about the things that they have struggled with and overcome. For the people who listen to this show, and I include myself in this, who just don't understand it because we haven't been there. And we talk about this all the time. And I think it's so important to try and keep an open mind about stuff. I mean, I have strong feelings about pretty much everything, but I try to keep an open mind, particularly when I'm hearing from people who have been places I haven't been. And I will say, when I started this off, I felt pretty sure this was a murder. I am less sure now. It's kind of crazy. We did all those episodes and we looked into this and we talked about it. I am less sure now just because of the things you guys wrote in. So many people wrote in and were willing to share that they had had experiences where they could have been Ellen, where they were in the middle of the most just ordinary, prosaic thing, folding the laundry, you know, washing the dishes, all that sort of stuff, when an overwhelming urge, which wasn't new to them, they had had suicidal thoughts before, maybe they had been struggling with mental illness or with depression, would come over them to the extent that were it not for sort of either things that they had sort of trained themselves to do to get out of those situations, or an interruption, sort of fortuitous phone ring or a roommate walks in, they might have killed themselves in a way that would have looked utterly bizarre to anyone who found them, because it would have seemed like this is so just out of the blue. And that is not something I have a lot of experience with. And hearing from you guys really made me question whether or not I was looking at this the wrong way. There's a lot of evidence in this case, and a lot of it's weird, and a lot of it points towards murder, but I am as confused, if not more confused, now than I was going into this case. And I think that just all comes back to, I think, the central point that we have been trying to make from the very beginning. Whether you think this is suicide or murder, it needs to be investigated more. These questions we've talked about have to be answered. This has to be taken seriously. And hopefully the people who are looking at this now are doing the job that should have been done 10 years ago.
Yeah, Brett, I just need to say I am blown away. If you guys could see our inbox right now, it is filled with some of the most vulnerable and open discussions from people who have been, you know, maybe where Ellen was in terms of anxiety and potentially having suicidal ideations. And we just feel so honored that you feel safe enough with us to share your stories. And it certainly opened up my eyes, and it's made me more compassionate and able to see my own blind spots of things I just don't know. So I just want to say thank you all to all of you for being vulnerable with us and being willing to share your stories. And I hope you continue to share your stories, because it certainly touched us. And I can only imagine how it will touch those around you who know you personally, and how much they can learn from your strength in overcoming more than I could ever imagine. So if whatever Ellen was going through in the last days of her life, because it seems like there was a lot going on, you know, if she had maybe heard some of your stories, maybe a different outcome would have come. And we don't know that now, except that, you know, thank you guys for going on this journey with us. We love hearing from you, because we do not know everything. We do not claim to know everything. And we are made better by all of you, as I think is evidenced by this episode. It was completely listener driven. And yeah, Brett, like you, I don't have any better answers, except that I do hope there are answers soon for Ellen's loved ones.
I do too. And that's all we can ask for, and that's all we can hope for. They've been fighting for a long time for answers, and I hope they get them, and I hope they get them both from Sam. I think Sam has some things to tell us about, and we will continue to follow this case. We'll continue to give you guys updates. Hopefully we learn more. Thank you guys for coming to this follow-up episode. It turned out to be about as long as a regular episode, longer than a regular episode, even. So Alice and I always have things to say. So there's always that. But for serious, this is the end of our Ellen Greenberg discussion for now. Next week is the beginning of October, and we will be in our October Halloween-y mood with still a true crime. So don't abandon us. Still a true crime. Just a little bit spookier than normal. Maybe a little bit more fun than normal and less depressing, we can hope. But otherwise, it will be the same old show, and we hope you guys will join us. Shoot us your emails, prosecutorspod@gmail.com, @prosecutorspod for all your social media. Keep it coming. Obviously, we pay attention. Sorry if I didn't get back to you. We just got so much feedback on Ellen Greenberg, it was hard for me to even keep up. But like I said, we will have a Get Vocal episode out for you guys tomorrow, so enjoy that. Otherwise, we will be back next week. But until then, I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Prosecutors. By now that I'd have this down to like a science, you know,
it's hard.
I mean?
I freeze like, every time, man.
Where I was like, oh yeah, I gotta have a word. I've only done this 150 times.
That's a lot of times.
I know, isn't that crazy? 150 times. That's a lot of episodes, Alice.
It's a lot of time spent on the phone.
That's just a lot of our talking, just endless yabbering. Look at us. What a business model.
What a business. We just record us.
Anywho, okay. Well, let's do this. Let's knock this out.
I'm sorry. Woo, woo. So this doesn't have to be long, in other words. We don't have to stretch this too
much. Let's just be as long as it is. I mean,
it'll probably
hour,
be
it
3 hours because it's just us.
I've never known us to do much of anything that went long.
I know.
So, you know. Anyway.
This month, celebrate Hispanic Heritage Month with Pluto TV. Watch movies with the biggest stars like Eugenio Derbez in No Eres Tú, Soy Yo, and Luis Gerardo Méndez in Camino a Marte. Plus, Pluto TV has thousands more movies and TV shows and over 45 channels in Spanish, all for free. So download the Pluto TV app on all your favorite devices and start streaming today. Pluto TV. Drop in, watch free.